Mmm, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
You're listening to Serious Inquiries Only.
Hello, and welcome to Serious Inquiries Only. This is episode 100. And I'm your host, Thomas Smith. Episode 100. I'm celebrating by doing an episode. Yay! You might remember I did celebrate 300 back, back when it was Atheistically Speaking. I did a big episode 300 spectacular. So the fact that I'm doing nothing for episode 100 looks a little more regular, a little less irregular, when you consider that it's really episode like 403 or something of, but that's a lot. Wow, 400 something episodes. So anyway, I guess what I will do is say thank you for listening. I know a lot of people have been with me from the very beginning. It means so much. And I'm celebrating by finally doing some more Red Pill. There are a lot of people who really enjoyed this. And in fact, I had one person comment that they actually only became a patron because I did a breakdown of the Red Pill. Kind of interesting. It's something I like doing. I like doing these deep dives into topics and trying to dismantle arguments. Or, by the way, if there's any sort of validity to an argument, then I want to give it credit. So there are places in the Red Pill Volume 1 where I gave the MRAs some credit. It's not as though everything they're saying is made up. Some of it is misleading, and I think there's a lot of problems with some of the logic, but a lot of it is these are genuine problems. It's not as though I don't believe it's any feminist position that women have everything horrible and every man has everything great. I don't think that's anyone's position. There are definitely issues that affect men more than women. But there's some context to put on that. So there's a couple things I want to bring back. I went back and listened to my volume one just to get it straight and make sure I'm not repeating myself. But there's a context that is crucial, that one small thing I do need to repeat, which is this Red Pill documentary where ostensibly, allegedly, a woman investigated the MRA movement and was a feminist. And at the end of the film, spoiler alert again, she says, I no longer call myself a feminist. And I called bullshit on her funding. It was funded by Milo Yiannopoulos fans and Cernovich fans, just two awful alt-right people. So if you want to go back, if you didn't hear that, if you listened to the Red Pill Volume 1, I talked about how the project became funded. And I would speculate that that had some effect on how she perceived it. I made the analogy that if let's say I, as an atheist, if I decided I wanted to make a documentary about Ken Ham or something and young earth creationism and no one would fund it, like no one, they're like, Thomas, we don't really care about your views on that. We're not funding your project. And then Ken Ham boosted it or something. And like all his followers donated tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars potentially. And then I was able to make the film because of that. You know, now I might take a very trollish attitude and just totally lay it on him, but I could see someone who respond in a way which is like, well, you know, there are some things to these young earth arguments. And, you know, I could see that clouding someone's judgment and effectively making it so that they wouldn't want to alienate who they're talking about. Because throughout this Red Pill documentary, she never really truly confronts any of the subjects on some of the truly misogynistic and awful things they've said. That'll be for a later part. I'm not going to cover those things today, if at all. We'll see if that's interesting to you guys. I had in my notes that would be a level of it that I could do. Another part of it is to look at the actual individual people making the arguments and sort of dismantle this air of respectability that they're given in the film. Because there are plenty of video clips of them saying really just disgusting things and showing who they really are, showing their true colors. So that is something I had in the notes, but we'll see if we want to take it that far. For today, what I wanted to bring up was that part I just mentioned where she goes through this process. She has her little video diary. In the end, she says, I'm no longer a feminist. I don't call myself a men's rights activist, I suppose, but I don't call myself a feminist. And it's very important to keep that in mind when evaluating these issues, because this isn't a framework of now that I know these issues, therefore I'm no longer going to call myself a feminist, which is a non sequitur in all of them, in my opinion, pretty much all of them. It's like if you had a video, let's say I'm a feminist, for example, and then I make a documentary on malaria and how it's killing so many children in some country. And then at the end, I say, well, I used to be a feminist, but boy, malaria, it's terrible. It's killing so many people. So I don't even call myself a feminist anymore. You would question that. Hopefully, if your faculties were intact, you would say, well, you could just be a feminist, but also if you'd rather give your money to charities that try to solve malaria, it's not as though anyone's going to be mad at you at that. So you can kind of do both. That's an important framework, because that's vital. The argument has to be, in order for this documentary and for MRAs and for Cassie J, the filmmaker, for any of that to make sense, it has to be that there are issues that affect men that are either A, ignored because of feminism, or are actively countered by feminists. Like, feminists actively don't care about them and make them worse. So that has to be part of it. Otherwise, you're just talking apples and oranges. You're just saying, well, okay, yes, there are many feminist issues that are valid, but then also there's some other issues that are valid. To which that's not an interesting documentary. Then you would just do a documentary about malaria, and everyone would say, oh yeah, holy crap, that I should be donating to that. Why am I not donating to that? And further, I'll remind you that I think I made a very good case. I'm going to continue that case today, that if you truly are a men's rights activist, and I know I have a couple of you listening, and you know what? I want to reach out a little olive branch here. I know I even have a couple of men's rights activists who listen and who seem to genuinely care about men's issues, not just as a way to deflect from feminism. And I want to give you that credit. I want to give you that benefit of the doubt if I'm speaking now there's only a couple that I've heard from. But if that's truly it for you, where you're like, well, it's not as though I'm not an anti-feminist. It's just I think there are men's issues that get ignored. If that's truly you, I totally have sympathy for that. I mean, maybe someone in your life committed suicide and you really care about the fact that more men successfully commit suicide. Now, as I debunked further last episode, more women attempt suicide. So if really we're going to go with the data of what's going on, I would want to ask the question, why are more women attempting suicide? Something's happening there. But I went through that last time. At any rate, maybe you know a man in your life who is homeless, and you looked at the homeless rate and all that, and that's why you care about these issues. I don't blame you for that. That's fine. I mean, I think everyone advocates for their issues. And the other thing I want to point out is that you cannot have it both ways when it comes to identity politics. If you are somebody who has been railing on identity politics and how it's ruining the left, it's ruining our politics, it's taking over liberals, all that, you cannot then turn on a dime and say, what about white men? Because then you are engaging in identity politics. Now, you have to be consistent one way or the other. You have to either say no identity politics whatsoever. I'm totally against that, and which I think will render you pretty useless as a citizen, as an engaged citizen. I think once you get rid, it's my view that you shouldn't do that. What you should do is recognize that virtually all politics is identity politics. And when it comes to things like Black Lives Matter, I think you should recognize, if you are somebody who is one of those anti-identity politics people, you should recognize how many white people like me there are saying, hey, you know what? Black Lives Matter is really important, and I'm not doing so because of my identity. That doesn't benefit me. I'm doing so because I think the data shows that there's a serious need for reform in a lot of areas related to Black Lives Matter. So you have to be consistent in that. And one thing that was just so horribly ironic and terrible about this Mythicist Milwaukee crowd was there was a point in that conversation where they did turn on that dime. They rail against identity politics. And then when the question was, do you, I can't remember if I asked them or if Sargon asked them. I don't remember, but I think I asked, who do you think has it worse, you know, men or women? And they clearly all said, I said, I think women have it worse, and they booed. Like, they were outraged that I would have even suggest that women have it worse than men, or I don't know if it was black men worse than white, whatever it was. You can't do both. You can't say, no, you know, we can't, everyone's an individual. We have to think of only individuals. We can't look at groups that people are in. And also white men have it worse. You can't do both those things. And a lot of this side does that. So that's a crucial bit of background when it comes to framing these issues is A, are they really diametrically opposed, or are we just talking, you know, malaria versus AIDS or something? Two things that we should both care about. Or are you engaging in identity politics the other way? And I think everybody needs to do their best to be consistent. And it's my belief that the best way to be consistent and the way that makes the most sense is to treat these issues with respect each way. Okay, so the first issue I'm going to reference, I'm not going to delve into, is family court being biased against men. So that's one of the claims of the film. And I think what frustrates me is they just have some weird one-sided... She interviews one guy about what his ex-wife did to him. And okay, that's fine. I'm open to there being stories of where the system goes wrong. I mean, that can happen either way. I mean, take the example of, you know, mass incarceration disproportionately affecting black men. Well, yeah, there's going to be white men that it also affects. I mean, I think there are plenty of white men who are in prison for the wrong reasons, too. It doesn't mean if I support Black Lives Matter and I support criminal justice reform, it doesn't mean that I like want white people in prison. It just means that I recognize that it disproportionately affects a certain group. And so that's what I would put this case in. I also think there wasn't any follow-up done. So if you're going to do a documentary, we're going to examine these issues, maybe try to contact the ex just to see if maybe there's another side of the story, because it gets really paranoid where this gentleman starts talking about how his mom wanted to make the kid that he didn't get access to custody of. She tried to make him fat and all this stuff, like just weird claims where it's like, okay, what am I doing with this? Like, do I know that's true? It's just one guy talking. You know, I mean, if you wanted to follow up and interview the ex, maybe that would be something. But otherwise, there's nothing. I'm more interested in what are the stats, what's happening, what at large, like what is the system? It's possible there can be a hiccup in the system, but in the larger scheme of things, what's happening? So that's what I want to know. And I'm not going to answer that question with respect to family court, because I actually found someone who would be a really good interview. And I say found. She found me. I was doing some research for this, and I had looked into my email. I'd searched something to find an old email that I wanted to pull up, and I found one that I hadn't seen. I feel really bad, but I hadn't seen where a divorce attorney had reached out to me after I did the Red Pill Part 1 and said, hey, this is something I know a lot about. If you want to interview me, let me know. And I hadn't seen it. Sorry. So I get a lot of emails, and sometimes they just slip through the cracks. Really sorry about that, but I contacted them. It was short notice, of course, so we're going to have to do that interview another time. But I think that'll be a great topic, because she has all kinds of stories of kind of both ways, you know, where the system, yeah, men are trying to take advantage of it, or women are actually trying to take advantage of the system. It happens both ways. I'm very curious to get her views and what she thinks about, like, overall, is there bias one way or the other? And I'm open to that. So we'll set aside that issue. That's going to be for a later date. And let's talk about some other issues. Now, here's where I'm going to throw another little olive branch to the MRAs or anyone concerned with these issues. There's a point where they say, someone is quoted of saying something essentially as, if men can't understand the female experience, then you need to listen to men to understand the male experience. And I want to throw one bit of context in that. The white male voice has been the dominant voice in our society forever. It's only recently that we're at all letting the dominant voice, or not even the dominant voice, like that we're even allowing other groups to chip away at that narrative. I mean, just look at this Me Too stuff. Look at how many reactions there were of, oh, I had no idea this was going on. Wow, I didn't know this was going on. Well, women have had to develop whisper networks and stuff like that because they aren't listened to when it comes to these things. They're, as I something I quoted somewhat recently in an episode, I'm blanking on which one, where if women reported sexual harassment, they actually, a majority of the time, would face more consequences. They would be ostracized, that sort of thing. So the dominant male voice, it's one thing to say, yes, there are some issues, and this is where, again, I'll throw a little olive branch. I think there are actually some issues where we do need to listen to men. And here's what I'll throw out there. I think one valuable place for men in this conversation is to talk about toxic masculinity and how it affects men. Because when I tell my wife stuff about what it was like in a locker room, for example, during high school men's sports, she is dumbfounded sometimes. I mean, it is, and I don't blame her, because high school boys do really, really stupid things, and it's sort of extreme. Doesn't mean high school girls don't as well, but I think this is an area where, when it comes to the effects of toxic masculinity, what it makes men do, how it affects us, how what it makes us feel we need to value, I think there's definitely room for men to talk about that. And I'll go so far as to say that if we didn't have men's voices in that issue talking about it, there would be a huge void in that conversation. I don't think, like, if we just only left it to, and I apologize, I want to say at the outset, this is a bit cis normative here. And I want to say, for any of my trans or gender fluid listeners, I'm just going to be talking about, because toxic masculinity and how it interacts and intersects with trans issues is not something I'm an expert at. I can't really talk about that. I want to acknowledge you and let you know that I apologize if you feel left out of this. I will say that I think these things affect people who are perceived as male and how they go through grade school, high school. I think that's what I'm specifically talking about, because I think toxic masculinity is a huge problem, and it's something that, if you haven't experienced it in that kind of context, in that bullying locker room, whatever, you know, will be boys context, I don't think you would really be able to understand. I do think that men's voices are critical in that situation. So again, just a bit of an olive branch, but what I want to very much emphasize is that the default voice has been the white male voice. That has been the one that has gotten the most play. And once again, it's just like the Christians with the war on Christmas, in my opinion. Once that crumbles a tiny bit, once that monopoly on the narrative crumbles a little bit, I think there's a huge amount of white male overreaction. So another few issues they toss out there, and they don't go too much into these, but they mention, here's things that, you know, feminists don't care about or society doesn't care about that only affect men or disproportionately affect men. Video game addiction, pornography addiction. And this is where I want to emphasize that those both are probably real problems. There's disputes in the research as to how prevalent or how big of an issue it is, but I'll take it for granted that, yeah, those are issues. Now, what I would want to know is, where are feminists contributing to that or hindering the research on it? Or why is this dichotomy set up as either you have to care about feminism or these issues? I mean, there are a billion issues that I don't pay attention to in my everyday life that I'm sure that if I happen to catch a documentary on and I happen to see a charity that said, you know, donate $10 to research to help some such and such, that I would do it. It's just we're as humans, we're a bit myopic in that we kind of, the last issue we see is what we tend to care about or what affects us or our home or family or friends. So I'll confess that video game addiction or porn addiction aren't two issues that I care that much about. I don't know anyone, or they don't affect me necessarily. But it's not just that, though. They may very well be issues, but I would want to know, what are the costs? What are the numbers? And furthermore, what are the potential solutions? Because it is one of those things that, again, when the other side of this tend to be all about individual responsibility, what are we going to do about it? Should we make video games less addictive? Should we mandate that the government intervene? Or should we, do we need to devote public resources to it? If it's something that we're proven to be having a big effect in our society, to the point where, you know, we're losing all kinds of productivity or people are dying because of it, then yeah, I would be open to initiatives to help that. But I don't think it's that level on either of these things, video game addiction or porn addiction. And they're things that largely rest on you and seeking help. So here's what I do support. And once again, this is why I firmly believe if you are an MRA, you should be a Democrat. You should vote Democrat, because what I would support is being able to get help, having access to healthcare, and therefore having access to therapy. So if you are suffering from this, if you feel like video game addiction or porn addiction is affecting your life and it's stopping you from doing things, I would want you to have access to healthcare, to be able to go to a therapist and or whatever we, you know, research shows is the appropriate response to that. I'm sure therapy is a good place to start to find out, you know, what do we need to do to fix this? I think it's also a bit ironic when it comes to video games, because so much of Gamergate was women saying, hey, let's maybe make games a little better for women, like more geared toward women, and a lot of men freaking out about that. And step one, by the way, we don't have good data on right now how much video game addiction, A, like how prevalent it is, B, how much it disproportionately affects boys versus girls or men versus women. We don't have great data on that, because I think it's going to be inaccurate if it's older than mobile phones. I've seen a lot of sources for like 2008, and it's like, okay, well, I think a significant factor right now, that data may have been valid back then, but I think a significant factor is going to be these mobile games, because I've actually seen stats that women prefer those, and the gender balance is much different when it comes to those kinds of games. And the data I'm seeing on just video game usage, it's not that big of a gap, and it has shrunk in recent years. So, A, I don't think this is necessarily that disproportionate to men. But B, I think a solution, one thing that would make it more evenly split, is if Anita Sarkeesian et al. Had their way and games were geared more toward women or girls, or just, you know, less toward violence and stuff. And by the way, that doesn't mean getting rid necessarily of certain games. It could just mean incorporating more games and having more diversity there. So that I found that kind of interesting, kind of ironic in a way. But I'll end this little section by saying, once again, A, feminists are not actively adding to this problem. In fact, I think they are solving it. they're largely either neutral or helping it. So this is not a dichotomy. This is not a choice. It's not either feminism or video game and porn addiction. And B, if you're addicted to, I was going to say, if you're addicted to porn or addicted to video games, which party would you rather have in power? But I would actually widen that to, if you are addicted to anything, who would you rather have in power, Democrats or Republicans? Republicans love punishing addicts for their behavior, and Democrats tend to favor treatment, you know, reducing sentences for stuff. By the way, Democrats tend to favor giving you access to healthcare. I don't say tend. Right now, it is strictly party line. Like, Democrats want you to have access to healthcare. Republicans want you to fend for yourself, and just, you know, if you can afford massive premiums, then Republicans are not going to physically stop you from paying those massive premiums. That's as far as they'll go. And the reason I keep bringing up the Democrat Republican thing, it's not exactly 100% because of red pill. I mean, it sort of is, because I did see that most of the people involved and interviewed with red pill were Trump supporters. Not, I want to emphasize, not all, because someone called me out on, I think one of them supported Hillary. And you know, there may be one or two, but most of them, I found quotes that they support Trump. And so that's, you know, it's a level of going against your own self-interest that I think reveals the game. The game is not, I care about these issues. The game is, I don't like feminists. I want to go against the party that tends to be associated with feminism, which is Democrats. So that's why I bring it up, because in the backdrop of this, and the people who are referencing these arguments are largely anti-feminist, largely, not all, largely anti-feminist, largely people who support Trump, or at least, you know, hate the Democrats and think that identity politics is ruining them. So that's why I bring it up. I really do firmly believe that if you genuinely care about these issues and you just want, you're not anti-feminist, you just want to solve these men's issues, then you should be a Democrat. Okay, for the rest of this, I'm going to talk about one of the biggest issues that I don't know if it's biggest in terms of time in the film, but I think it is probably one of the best cases that MRAs have for men are being discriminated against. And I want to give it its due. It has to do with sentencing, where there's gender disparities in sentencing. So men get sentenced to more time, longer sentences than women for similar crimes. That's the claim made. I think this is likely one of the best cases that MRAs have or people who care about these issues have when it comes to like discrimination against men. I do think that there's a case to be made here. I want to look at it. I want to look at the data. I want to talk about some of the nuances of the data. There's some confounding issues to talk about. So that'll be the rest of the episode is discussing this major issue because I think it is major. And I want to make sure to steel man this. I really do want to do my best in all things to try to be fair. And the biggest source that I'm seeing, the most in-depth and the most referenced source I'm seeing is a study by someone named Sonia Starr, who at the time of the study was an assistant law professor at the University of Michigan. Not sure what she's up to now, but that's where the study was done out of. Cutting to the punchline, this is the stat that MRAs reference. They say that men are sentenced to 63% longer on average than women for equivalent crimes as can best be controlled. So 63%, that's a staggering number, very large, something that, if true, should definitely be of concern to every citizen. I mean, that's just a gigantic disparity. And it's probably unconstitutional, really, if two people in a protected class like sex are treated vastly differently in that way. That's something we should all be concerned about. Couple things to talk about in terms of the study. First off, it's only federal court. So I'm looking at numbers here. Federal prisoners account for roughly 10% of total prisoners. I'm not sure how that would translate to total people who go through the system. You know, there may be more who go through, you know, the local systems that don't end up with sentences. So I don't have those numbers. I wasn't able to find like how many people go through this system in total, but we can assume it's probably something like 10%. It's probably similar to the proportion in prison. Maybe not, but it should be somewhere in the ballpark. So I do want to point out that this data is only reflective of something like 10% of the total prison population. But still, I mean, there's no reason to suspect that if the federal numbers are so skewed toward men getting longer sentences, I don't know of any reason to suspect that it would be vastly different in state or local jails or whatever. I think that it's reasonable to conclude that this is a bias that is probably everywhere. Now, I've talked about mass incarceration quite a bit on this podcast. Now, here's something that's probably depressing, but it's a mixed bag. So this is decreasing. This discrepancy is decreasing because the number of women in prison has been increasing at a rate 50% higher than men since 1980. So the system is catching up. The patriarchy or somebody, I don't know who, is catching up and has decided, you know what, it's time to no longer be soft on women. We need to get them in prison at a higher rate, but it's still very big. So the discrepancy does seem to be real. I've read this entire study. It's very deep. It's very dense, but it seems pretty sound, and I'm not going to make too many bones about the data. I will say one thing that, once again, I said this a lot last time. If MRAs want to open the Pandora's box of the data, be ready to find that in actuality, who's getting the brunt of the mistreatment is people of color. And this remains true. Now, black men explain a significant portion of this discrepancy, but not the whole thing. So remember when I talked about the homelessness rate, and it's actually true that if you took out people of color, men and women were homeless at a very similar rate. And so therefore, if you're going to those arguments for why, you know, like men are mistreated, you really ought to be arguing that we're mistreating people of color. And I emphasized that at the time. This time, it's not exactly true. So while it is true that if you take out people of color, or specifically black men and women, then the gap reduces. So it goes from something like 63% to somewhere around 50%. So that explains a portion of it. We just really treat black men differently in this country and we sentence them more harshly. But that's not even the majority. That's not even half, you know, going from 63% to 50% means that there still is significant discrepancies in our sentences between men and women. And I want to give this argument credit. It does seem to be, in my opinion, this seems to be the place where sexism or I don't know what you want to call it, but discrimination is going against men in this instance. I do want to point out there's a couple places where the system really strongly disfavors women, and that is when it comes to killing your intimate partner. So, and once again, this is heteronormative, but when it's a man who kills his wife, the sentence is actually usually less than a wife who kills the husband. And there's some speculation that this could be because when a woman has to kill her husband, when a woman decides to kill her husband, it's usually with a weapon. She has to use a weapon. That's why I jumped to that word. Whereas men often can kill their wives with their bare hands. And it's speculated by some that that using a weapon, for some reason, we see that even though the crime is the same, either way, you've killed a person. Somehow using a weapon is like viewed more harshly than not using a weapon when it comes to sentencing, which that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. It seems to me that murder is murder and, you know, premeditated is premeditated and equivalent murders are equivalent. I don't see why the weapon should make a difference. One other thing to point out that I think is interesting is that something like 90%, depending on the source, I've seen 93%, I've seen a little less than that, 90% around of all women who are in prison for killing their partner were abused by their partner. So that is an interesting wrinkle. I think we can talk more about that later on when we get to a segment on domestic violence, because that is a major issue of the red pill and one that probably might deserve its own episode because there's a lot to talk about. But anyway, those are some interesting variables in the whole thing. But it is true, nonetheless, big discrepancy between men and women. Sentences certainly are shorter for women. So then we want to talk about why. And it's actually, according to this study, if we're going to keep referencing this study, which makes, I think, the best case for discrimination here, it's not really in the judge's hands. It's actually incremental differences at many phases in the process. So one thing this study did that Sonia Starr, the author, says that other studies haven't done is account for when there's no prison time or no jail time. They somehow factored that in, or she did, in order to make the scoring more fair in her mind, because other studies have found a lower discrepancy. And again, that's why I use the study. It's found the highest discrepancy. There are others that claim it's a bit lower, but we'll go with this one. Anyway, this study puts a lot of the burden on prosecutors. And as you know, I've talked about prosecutorial discretion because a lot of the sentencing guidelines are pretty rigid. They're pretty much, you know, a matrix, which is what's the crime and what's the criminal history. And that wouldn't really allow for all that much discrimination, because if you fit into a certain box in the matrix, you get a certain number of years. So you can expect that if you control for those factors, while it may be true that men more often have criminal history, if you control for that, you would still expect to see a very similar result, but we don't. So it's actually alleged in the study that it's likely discrimination in multiple stages. So it's like a little bit of discrimination, largely in the hands of the prosecutor. Some of it is still in the hands of the judges. In fact, there's a major court case in 2005 called Booker that rendered these sentencing guidelines as advisory rather than mandatory. And many people thought that would increase the discrepancies, but studies have found that it hasn't increased them all that much because they still are widely used. But there is still some discretion there. So part of it can certainly be some sort of patriarchy, some sort of feeling among judges that, you know, women are inherently less of a threat. You know, and that's what I want to get at. All of these factors, and it's, again, it's largely in the hands of prosecutors, which is why when I always quote that thing, 95% of prosecutors are white. So I think it would be really foolish to imagine that doesn't make some sort of difference in terms of the racism in our system. But in terms of the gender discrepancy, it can have the opposite effect. So the more women are involved in the process, the more this gap disappears. So one study found that if you have female judge, if you have, female prosecutor, it reduces the discrepancy, actually. So another reason to elect women to these roles where they are elected. Sometimes they're appointed, sometimes they're elected. Prosecutors are elected. So female prosecutors, that might be a good idea. But anyway, I want to talk about the false dichotomy part. Because while I think the best argument you could make for the red pill people is that people don't pay enough attention to this. Because one of my sources here, I think this is really interesting, is a Reddit called r Ask Feminists. And someone posed this question. And they did it in a pretty much a bad faith way. It's a trash account that they're trying to stir the pot. But nonetheless, this Reddit thread of Ask Feminists is actually designed for things like this, where if you want to know what feminists think on an issue, or at least the feminists that are on this Reddit thread, but they're somewhat representative, then you can pose a question and they'll answer. And this question is posed, what do you think about the 60% discount on prison sentences? Which, by the way, is incorrect. It's men's sentences are 60% longer, 63% longer. It's not a 60% discount. So that's the opposite. But anyway, it was posed in sort of an inflammatory way. They didn't offer any proof. They didn't reference the study. But nonetheless, feminists still answered. And all of them said, yeah, well, we should just sentence men shorter. It wasn't as though any of the feminists said, oh, good, because women, they're fine. We don't want to sentence them. We want to imprison men. So while you may be able to find some insane Tumblr feminist somewhere who thinks that men should be imprisoned, that's not representative. And in fact, this Reddit thread is very interesting. I see in this Reddit thread a lot of people trying to find the data. Some person offered the actual study that I referenced and said, oh, I think it's coming from this. Lots of good faith efforts to evaluate this question, which I think is representative of what I see from the feminists I know, which is a willingness to engage in these questions and a willingness to say, yeah, this does disproportionately affect men. However, the reason is toxic masculinity or toxic gender roles, that's a big reason for it. So seeing women as more harmless or as inherently victims, all that kind of stuff, that is gender roles. And no feminist that I know, and certainly if no self-respecting feminist, no feminist who I think is well-versed in the data, would ever say that gender roles only affect women negatively. They certainly affect men negatively. And once again, I have to ask you this. If you are concerned with the sentencing disparity, which I think we should be, I think we should be very concerned with the sentencing disparity. Now, when I say there's a big disparity in racial sentencing and your response is, well, the gender gap is different, that's not a valid response to the racism in the system, because the racial gap is still very large, and not just in sentencing. Sentencing is one component of it. The other component is how much we police black neighborhoods, all that kind of stuff. So sentencing and comparing equal sentences is only one portion of it, or rather comparing equal crimes and the sentences for them. So all this is to say, that is a response I received when I spoke to people at the Mythicist Milwaukee thing. I specifically remember someone in particular responding with the whataboutery of, what about the gender discrepancy? To which I said, yeah, no, that sounds bad. Let's do something about that. Now, which party, and in fact, which candidate in the 2016 election had criminal justice reform as a strong point in their policy? That was Hillary Clinton. So if, once again, you care about men's issues, you ought to have voted for Hillary Clinton and you ought to vote Democrat, because they really, in all of these that we've covered so far, Democrats are again, they're not perfect. There's plenty of flaws with Democrats. There's plenty of flawed people in the Democratic Party. We're seeing that when these sexual harassment scandals, or indeed sometimes sexual assault scandals, are exploding. It affects Democrats just as much as Republicans. That being said, in terms of platform and in terms of which party, given our two-party system, you would want in power if you are a men's rights activist, it should be Democrats, because they are the only ones who actually propose solutions to these things. And I, for one, think that the sentencing discrepancy is very large. It's very disturbing. It's not fair. It's not fair. It shouldn't be true that men and women should get sentenced so differently for similar crimes and for similarly situated people. So like criminal history, all that, when you control for all that, there's still a huge gap, and that is not fair. And I don't, again, in this forum for Ask Feminists, nowhere did I see, oh good, we want that discrepancy. Nowhere did I see that. And I think if you ask any feminist, if you just stop and ask any feminist, you know, any, again, non, out there person rando from Tumblr who says alarming things, you know, that's not representative. But just ask a normal person, an everyday person, you know, who is a feminist, what they think about this sentencing gap. And I guarantee you they'll say, well, we ought to sentence men, we ought to reduce the sentences of men, we ought to equal that gap, because it's not fair. You know, I meant to mention also another way that this could be reduced is by more women being in positions of power. Because one factor is studies show that just objectification is a big factor. So like, if you're attracted to the person, then you're going to be more lenient. And there's a gender gap in this, because there are far more heterosexual men in positions of power, especially historically. So therefore, when it's a good-looking woman, they're going to favor them and they're not going to have any sympathy for men. That's a major factor, studies show. But also, it does affect merely people who society views as less attractive, regardless of gender. And that's another thing that's totally unfair. I mean, while we're going to do some whataboutery, you know, these sentences ought to be fair for everybody. They really should. That goes for race, that goes for gender, and that goes for if the person is good looking or not. You know, that shouldn't be a factor. What should be a factor is, we should do our best to make it reasonable based on the crime and based on the history. I think we ought to far and away favor rehabilitation over punishment. We ought to not imprison addicts. We ought to, you know, there's all kinds of things. There's all kinds of room for criminal justice reform that I think would go a long way toward fixing this particular discrepancy. But once again, if you want that to happen, liberals are closer to the mark on that, while still not perfect by any means. And I think that's an area that I look forward to liberals, once we can assume any sort of power in the backlash of 2018 that I think is coming. That's an area that I think we can improve upon. But you have no chance if you're a conservative. I mean, if Republicans are in power, it's only going to get worse. Another thing I wanted to bring up before we come to a close here is, when you look at age, there's this pretty perverse and depressing effect where younger people are far and away treated more leniently. So they're given lesser sentences, I guess, because, you know, they have time to change their ways, or maybe they're viewed as more favorable, unless you're talking about younger Black people. Young Black men actually get harsher sentences than older Black men. So we do view young Black men as far more dangerous than any other demographic, and it's very depressing. I just wanted to bring that up while we're looking at these statistics. Because again, if you're going to swear by these statistics, as the MRAs do in the red pill, then you have to follow them and actually go where they lead. And in all fairness, it does tell you that the gender gap is large. So that's why I wanted to give this argument every bit of fairness that it deserves. It's not something that we should ignore. And if an MRA brings it up, my recommendation would be to say, oh yeah, that's something we ought to fix. That's why I favor criminal justice reform. I hope you'll be voting for whoever the Democrat is in the next presidential election. And furthermore, I hope you'll be voting for anyone. And by the way, we don't even have to make it Democrat versus Republican. You could just say, I hope you'll be voting for whoever favors criminal justice reform, programs for the homeless, which was another major issue from part one, affordable health care for everyone, which affects many of these issues, but specifically suicide rate and homelessness. That's a big workplace fatality. So I hope you'll be voting for whoever also is in favor of tight regulation of job safety, because that's who's going to solve these men's issues for you. And wouldn't you know it, those are all very, very left-wing ideas and not right-wing ideas. So there you go. That's where I suppose for today I will rest my case in terms of why MRAs ought to be Democrats. And also, that's it for this part of the Red Pill. There's more to talk about. Let me know what you think. Hey, I wanted to throw out there, you know, I was listening to the latest Sam Harris. I still listen, but I check it ahead of time because if he's going to have Jordan B. Peterson on or something. I don't want to hear someone complain about colleges and how they're ruining free speech. I'm so tired of that I check it. Anyway, I still listen to it when it's an ostensibly neutral or philosophy topic or something that's not going to be how identity politics is killing the left. And there was one about population ethics and antinatalism and some other issues. And I think I have some interesting things to say on that. In fact, I almost did this episode on that, but I was tired of depriving everybody of part two because people kept asking when I was finally going to get to Red Pill part two. I didn't want to do another switcheroo, but let me know if that's something you would be interested in. I have a lot of thoughts on moral epistemology and specifically Sam Harris's moral epistemology and what I think he and his guest were missing. I think there's a key ingredient and a reason they were not able to communicate that. I would love to talk about, but I was sort of hesitant because I don't know how much you guys want to hear that, but it is something that does really interest me. So if you want to toss me a message, an email or anything, voicemail, let me know if that's something you'd be interested in. I also need to make a quick announcement about Patreon. They sent out an email. I'm really frustrated with this. It was a very short notice thing. They said they're instituting a change. So their excuse for this was that they want creators to definitely take home 95%. And so therefore they were going to shift the fee to the patron rather than collecting it from the creator. Now, on paper, and if we believe that, that sounds like a, you know, whatever. I guess that shifts a cost more toward the patron. Maybe that's not something the patron would like, but they can always respond by reducing their pledge, I suppose. So I was like, okay, whatever. But there's a detail in there that is absolutely ridiculous. It's something that I've been corresponding with them to try to get them to change. The last I heard from them, they were checking with the team. I don't know if it's going to go anywhere. But in this fee shifting, that what they have done is really screwed over people who post a lot. So instead of just charging their credit card fees once at the end of the month, they're charging a 35-cent fee in addition to 2.9%. But that doesn't matter because 2.9% doesn't change however many times you do it. So if you do 2.9% for each post, it's still 2.9% of the total. However, if you add 35 cents to every paid post, which is what they said they're going to do, it's idiotic. It unfairly and for no good reason burdens people like me who post more. So for a monthly account, it doesn't make much difference. For someone who posts twice a week like I do, it makes a substantial difference. It turns every dollar pledge into like $1.50. So it's ridiculous. It's unfair. But it hasn't gone through yet. So what I want to ask you, if you're a patron, I ask you to please at least give me through December to figure this out. And that means I'm either going to work with them to try to get them to not do that part of it. So we'll see. Or I'll try to find some alternative to Patreon. But please give me through December. The change is going to go through in late December. So it won't make too much of a difference. It'll only affect a couple posts. So it'll be a few cents. But it is really unfair. It's not something I think that you should have to put up with. All I'd ask is that given we're already in December and this is how I make my living, please don't do anything drastic until, you know, at least January. If you're going to reduce your pledge, you know, I understand it. I totally do. All I'm pleading for is give me December to get this figured out. But it is an outrage. I encourage you to contact Patreon and tell them that you won't put up with this and that it very unfairly affects people who support creators who are per paid post rather than monthly. If you're not on Patreon, you can ignore all that. Sorry about that. But you also should support me, patreon.com/seriouspod. But anyway, I'm going to try to see if there's an alternative or if they'll reconsider that part of it. They really should charge the 35 cents only once per month per person, and then this would be a very insignificant change. It would just increase the patron cost by a tiny bit, but that amount would go to make sure the creator had more balance in what they get every month rather than being subject to the changing credit card fees. So I encourage you to contact them. It's absolute bullshit. I'm going to do my best. I'm just hoping you'll give me that grace period of December to figure that out. But thank you so much to anyone who supports me. Really, this is a reminder of how incredible it is that I'm able to do this. And it really is all because of my patrons. Thank you so much. I absolutely value you. I want to get this figured out because it shouldn't affect you. This is unfair that it is affecting you. And on that note, I want to thank my new patrons, Martin Fidel, Kuiper Belt Transport dot space. That's pretty cool. Corey Hill, Saba Today, Left at the Valley Podcast, and Vegan Danimal. Thank you so much for the new pledges. We'll get it figured out, I promise. And by the way, this doesn't actually affect the higher dollar pledgers as much because of the percentages. So the 35 cents relative to a dollar is a lot. Relative to $10, it's not as much as a percentage. Now, don't get me wrong. Either way, it's stupid. They shouldn't be doing it. Totally agree. But that's why I brought up the $1 example, because like as a percentage, it's ridiculous how much it increases the burden on $1 patrons. And it's time to thank my all-time greats. I'm still going to do it, especially with how crappy Patreon is. Those who stick with it, really, it means a lot to me. I will note also, I sent some messages out because there are a ton of declined pledges this month, enough to where I'm wondering if it's like a Patreon glitch. Reason number 9 million that I think I need to just find an alternative and try to start setting that up. But anyway, if you are a patron, you know, you might have gotten a message from me because there's just an extraordinarily large number of declined pledges. So please check that out if you got a message. But anyway, thank you to Matt Garrett, Peter Skelton, Roger Metcalf, and the International Waters. I love it. Andrew Waddington, Ian Ryan, Matthew Vernon, Ray Loves Jenny, Robin, the Zika Baby That Lives, Supports Refugee Rights, Marcel, the Jake Don't Call Me a Ninja Without My Written Consent. That's awesome. Abeson, Beth Deitch, Sammy, Luke Boucher, A New Lefty Blog, SinisterMarginalia.net, Scott M., Marco Rosano, Embrace the Void, James Hamblin, Randy Waddell, Jay, Heather G. Peters, Derek Barnett, Frank Ferriello, Nate Sheets, I Need to Stop Taking Legal Advice from Podcasts, CampQuest.blorg, 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 that's funny, Dan Wheatley, Tim, listen to Brand New Science Fiction. Sorry, it always trips me up. Tricicular Manslaughter, Elizabeth Ocon, Karen Sheets Soul, Peter Draganadik, Michael Schaefer has not yet been indicted by Mueller. Woohoo. Jim Shaver, Corey Johnson, host of the Brainstorm Podcast and the Hardcore Skeptic, Dan Griffith, Jonathan Moyer, Hunter Ash, Mitchell, May Sapien 88, Marissa Alexa McCool and Bethany Futrell, and Marissa Alexa McCool and Ari Stillman. Thank you so much. And our best-smelling patron, Michael Rops. Thank you, guys. Really, you deserve all the thanks in the world. You are my top patrons. You make the show happen. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I hope you'll continue to leave voicemails. Those are really fun. I love doing those episodes. And I'll see you on Monday.